Your XO makes emotional decisions. Just like my daddy. Just like my goddamn daddy. The Beast said, as soon as you were discharged from service, you went back to Los Angeles to kill the men who offended you when you were a child. The thieves had stolen my toys. They were boys when they robbed you. They had it coming. You talked about finding and killing them for years. I didn't actually think you would. If I had had the time, instead of just shooting them when they opened the door, I would have injected mercury into their brains and watched them suffer as their heads shrank to the size of a pea. I don't like being fucked over. I don't like losing. Never have. Never will. He began tapping the table again. The Beast motioned. He stopped. The Beast nodded toward the amorous couple. Jesus, that old fuck is going to suck the young woman's tongue out of her mouth, if she doesn't suck his out of his mouth first. Medianoche stood, looked around. Magnificent cathedrals and outstanding architecture everywhere, delicious food and historical attractions galore. He checked his Movado watch and casually strolled toward the amorous, kissy-kissy couple. The older, married man was all but screwing the young woman he was with in public. Medianoche made sure he didn't step in a pile of gooey canine excrement. He could step in a pile of dog poop, slide, and throw everything off. He'd seen well-trained men stumble on a rock, then get taken out in combat. He eased his weapon out from under his suit coat, one with a suppressor. The unfaithful Walloon saw death coming and yelled,
"Qu'est-ce qui se passe?"
Medianoche put two in the married man's head, two to be sure. He was a politician out of Belgium, more crooked than Lombard Street in San Francisco. The man's two bodyguards, the East Africans, were gunned down by the Beast before they could react. Three bodies dropped, and the woman who was seated at the bistro table with her lover, his Parisian mistress, screamed and fell to the ground. She scuttled away, actually crawled over a steaming pile of dog poo, and ended up with her stained hands covering her head, trying to hide from the two boogeymen. They'd laugh about that later, and they would laugh long and hard. Within seconds, Medianoche and the Beast were in a Peugeot, Medianoche behind the wheel, speeding toward Notre Dame. One more meeting, then the day would be done. That was the same day they met two other men who joined the horsemen, their latest recruits. The week before, the previous two had become members who were no longer of any use, so they needed replacements. The Beast had always been the commanding officer, Medianoche the executive officer. Those were the two everyone feared. Medianoche followed command, but only the command of the man he trusted. When a good soldier had a fearless and flawless leader, he followed every command without question. After picking up the new horsemen, it was R&R time, time spent hanging out on the Champs-Élysées, taking in shows at the Moulin Rouge, drinking, snorting a few lines, partying with their new recruits, then to a brothel on Rue Saint-Sulpice in the 6th arrondissement. Medianoche had lost his taste for French women. He would kill one before he took her to bed. He went to brothels, but would pay to be with only the Africans and the West Indians. Even after the jobs from Jerusalem to Washington, a month later when they were finally back at Cape d'Agde, he avoided the French women. Paid for or complimentary, he'd never let another French girl touch his loins. He would have killed them all for free. Because of Thelma. The things Medianoche and the Beast did together as young men, as warriors who felt like they owned the world and were entitled to every pleasure and glory, things he would never do with any other man, should have served to bond them, but it served only to make the betrayal the Beast had brought to the table that much harder to bear. The Beast had been in contact with Thelma. He had never been out of contact with Thelma. He had had rendezvous with the French slut. He had impregnated her. They had a son. Gideon's whore of a mother had had a second son, courtesy of the Beast. When the Beast had gone away on solo missions over the years, he had met with her. He had fucked her in Amsterdam. He had been with her in Germany. That much Medianoche knew for sure. Medianoche had uncovered the Beast's lies yesterday. His commander, his CO, had smiled in his face, shared wine, whiskey, and women, and lied to him for 2 decades. That was why, After their war with the scams organization, with emotions high and the treachery exposed, Medianoche had snapped, had turned his weapon away from someone who had been chosen to die, and aimed his gun in the direction of his best friend, his brother, and, without pause, had blown his fucking brains out. He'd wanted his brother to know what it felt like to be shot in the fucking head. Medianoche had killed his brother. Medianoche had killed the beast. Chapter 3. All the King's Men. The recall ended abruptly, like a car slamming on the brakes but still hitting a deer the size of a FedEx truck. Medianoche jerked awake, sweating, heart racing like he was in a firefight, not knowing how much time had passed, hours or days. His eyes went to the clock. Only 3 moments had gone by. Caprico Ortiz was still in his arms, sleeping, oblivious to his journey. If he had been in battle and suffered a blackout like that, it would have been certain death. His blackouts were why Gideon was not dead. In the Vishas, the devil had been on his side. Medianoche shook Caprico Ortiz gently, then whispered her name. She woke in a panic, eyes wide, checked the time.
I must leave.
I know. Don't want you to get in trouble with your husband, she said.
3 times in 2 hours.
Would make it 4 if I had the time and the juice. The gun still worked, though it took longer to reload and it didn't fire as often. But when it discharged, it was a cannon. If time and age were on his side, he would have reloaded and had her face down, ass up, and given her back shots until sunrise, until his cock suffered from carpal tunnel. She yawned.
Me pica el magre.
Yeah, I'm hungry too. A good fuck took away stress, cleaned the pipes, cleared the head, allowed a warrior to calm and think clearly. But Medianoche knew he couldn't fuck enough to remove the stress this time. She asked,
May I take a quick shower before returning to my family?
Go ahead. I need to take care of some business. Take your time. She could barely stand. And when she did find her footing, her walk was unsteady. He had her walking from side to side. After she had done a sashay stagger back to the bathroom, he turned the television on. The president of Argentina was on, her beautiful face contorted, outraged, condemning the violence that had traveled across Buenos Aires yesterday. She said cocaine and paco, Argentina's equivalent to crack, were destroying her country, corrupting the rich and addicting the poor. And she vowed to end the drug problems. Medianoche cursed her. She mentioned the damage to the rich areas, but said nothing about the damage in the Vishas where the poor lived. The Vishas weren't even on the maps. They were the government's shame. They were areas the leaders couldn't control and wished would disappear. In every other sentence she spoke, the Colombians and their drug wars were blamed. All bullshit. The president knew. He turned the television off. Glanced toward his suit, his fedora, his guns. He was still irritated. Heard a noise in the hallway and jumped, went for his guns. This battle had just ended, and he had no idea where the insurgents were, if Gideon was lurking around a corner, if scams or that bitch, Arizona, were in the shadows. He had to stay on guard. Pussy had been good, but pussy hadn't been good enough to dull it all. He wanted to drink too much and drive too fast and kill, kill, kill. And to concentrate. Sleep would do him no good. Medianoche had depended on the beast for decades. Now Medianoche was the commanding officer. He no longer had to take orders from the lying beast. No longer could he be called his lapdog. The beast was gone, but he had to think with the heart of the beast. That memory, that vision, that moment of the past was like a message from the dead. He had to deliberate, not like a soldier taking orders, but like a king slash warrior. Earlier, he had sent Senorita Raven, the only other remaining horseman, on a mission that would take her to the West Indies and the island of Montserrat. He knew now that that had been an emotional decision. That mission was useless, wouldn't benefit the 4 horsemen. He needed to keep boots on the ground, had to protect his base, not send his only remaining soldier away to handle his personal demon. He picked up his cellular, called Senorita Raven. He hoped she wasn't in the air en route to the West Indies, though she should have been.
but the Punjabi from St. Louis answered right away, sounded anxious, still wired up.
Sir, yes, sir.
Change in plans, soldier. Back to base.
Why are you canceling the order you just gave me a few hours ago?
Medianoche said, soon I will return to Montserrat and take care of that issue myself.
Sir, I just arrived at Azaza International. I have my boarding pass.
You're just arriving at the airport? Where have you been the past few hours?
Señor Rodriguez, sir. That was a priority. I wasn't going to leave his body unclaimed in the morgue. Gideon killed him and he was left on a train. I went to collect his body as I told you I would do. I told him I was his girlfriend and claimed his body. I owed that to Señor Rodriguez. And sir, I expect you to hold up to your promise and send his body home to his family.
Even if you had claimed his remains, you should have been in the air by now.
Again? The scams organization, sir. Those motherfuckers served us a soup sandwich.
Chain of command. The beast is gone. I'm your commanding officer, and you don't make decisions that impact the horsemen on your own. Do you fucking understand the words coming out of my goddamn mouth?
Sir, I understand, sir.
Return. The beast kept a list of GIs he'd used to replace any of us. Worst case scenario. You violated protocol and hacked into the system and no doubt saw the files.
What file should your executive officer one search for when I return?
Medianoche paused. The disposables. It should be labeled Los Desechables.
Why are they called the disposables?
He ended the call, not in the mood to explain himself to a problematic soldier. Three times Medianoche had tried to become a family man. Three times he'd failed. The first two marriages, in the end, were inconsequential. The third had taken root and held him by the heart. Gracelyn was his third wife, the one he'd loved the most, the one he could never forget, the only one who had rejected him when he told her who he really was. When he had come clean and explained to her what he did, when he had told her he was a mercenary, a man other men and countries hired to do their dirty work, she wanted nothing to do with the blood on his hands. The god she praised was a merciful god of peace, not a merciless god of war. Medianoche was not a man who could let things go. He would go to Montserrat and visit his third wife, and when he saw her again, his would be the last face she ever saw. Yes, he wouldn't send a horseman. He would go there and do it himself. The bathroom door opened. Keptico Ortiz had her phone in her hand, was ending a call. He stood and asked, any word from your contact on the assassin named Gideon?
He has heard of him. Many people have heard of him.
And?
They say he is the son of the devil.
Chapter 4. City Across the River.
In Buenos Aires, I jumped out of moving trains. Shotgun and I had fallen from buildings. All of us had been shot at with bullets and dodged grenades. But more important, accidentally, I had met the man I knew as Midnight. In the slum of Buenos Aires, I'd gone hand to hand against that mercenary. We'd gone fist to fist, kick for kick, knee for knee, elbow for elbow, and blow for blow. He was older, but he was fast. He was strong. He was wicked. He was deadly. He had pounded me in ways I've never been struck before. Every ache and pain I felt now was due to that fight, and I had tried to serve him worse, plus a special dessert. Midnight and I had battled. I'd fought Medianoche. That was his name in Buenos Aires. Medianoche. I'd gone into hell and fought a demon brought back from the dead. We had brawled in the winter rain. That had been the hardest fight I'd ever had. He was everything my mother had said he was, and more. For me, this contract had started in Miami, doing a job for the international grifter, Arizona. I'd taken a contract that had me dispatching one of her rivals, a man by the name of Hopkins. Somehow, he had conned her out of $15 million, but he had a briefcase that, paired with an identical one, would hold the key to extreme wealth. After that job, I went to meet Arizona and was surprised when she wobbled into the Aventura Starbucks, pregnant. There, she told me my part wasn't done. Arizona reminded me of a debt I owed her new lover, Scams, the man who had taken his own father's name. Once upon a time, he had saved my life. He wanted reciprocity for that small favor, getting the other briefcase. That debt had taken me to Argentina, and I had faced a group called the Four Horsemen.
Argentina had been 10 flavors of hell. It had been one long battle with no pause. As it rained, we were attacked with bullets and sledgehammers, and the leader of those lunatics was the man they called Medianoche. There was no doubt he was the man I had known as Midnight, but I had killed a man named Midnight a long time ago. I'd killed him to stop him from choking my mother to death. In North Carolina, I'd sat next to my mother and watched him die. Somehow, he had defeated death, and fate had made our paths cross once again. My face was swollen, same for one eye. I could barely open and close my hands, and my soul, for the first time, was fractured. My heartbeat was erratic. I anticipated the four horsemen would magically appear, guns blazing and grenades flying. Argentina had been more than traumatic. It was like being thrown into Fallujah. The faint echoes from the explosions remained in my ears. The stench from Buenos Aires Visha 31 remained in my nostrils, and the sewage that had inundated my damaged skin would take weeks to wash away. And the pain from my fight with Midnight had saturated my bones. I felt like Robin fighting Batman, the student against the master. No, more like Robin fighting Deathstroke, the mercenary who could defeat Batman because he had no morals, no code, no honor. He was faster and stronger than I had thought he would be. I wasn't as good as I thought I was, not compared to him. I felt something else. I felt doubt. I was younger, but he was so fucking powerful. I'd never felt that way before. He still wasn't dead, but I told myself that I was safe for now, that all of my friends were safe. Everything was as normal as it could be for people like us. Sometimes a man had to lie to himself in order not to lose the plot. We had escaped Buenos Aires, crossed the river on a yacht that the British con man Scams and his lover, Arizona, had used to transport both their wounded and their dead. Funds had been transferred. Our job was done. Then I collected my crew and we had gone our separate ways. We were taking the bus from Colonia del Sacramento to Montevideo, where we would plan our escape out of the country. I was with Shotgun, the heavyweight boxer turned assassin, and Constantine, the Russian hitman who many said looked like George Clooney or Cary Grant, depending on the angle. He was also known as the man in the white shoes. After going up against the four horsemen of the apocalypse, both were wounded, but both were in much better shape than I was in. War was hell, and this had been whatever existed on the other side of hell. Colonia to Montevideo wasn't that far, about 177 kilometers or 110 miles. We were only across the Rio de la Plata. We were still in horseman territory. We were still trying to breathe while living in the heated mouth of danger. By the time the crowded bus arrived in Montevideo, Shotgun and Constantine were both awake and talking in English. Hardly an ear on the bus understood English, and if they did, Shotgun's southern accent and southern fried colloquialisms would have left them baffled. I had stayed awake, on guard, while they slept the last leg of the trip. The bus hit a bump and rocked, and both had woken suddenly, like they were having flashbacks, had freed themselves from nightmares and were ready to fight. We surveyed the terrain, took note of any car coming up behind us. The horsemen had destroyed Vicious to get to us, so I knew they would blow up the bus we were on, kill everyone, just to satiate their appetite. I'd gone up against many people, had fought for my life more times than I could remember, and I had never met anyone so damn evil. Medianoche. Midnight. He was the man my mother had told me was my father. He had a good left hook, if nothing else. He had a chin like a brick and could take a blow. Rain poured as the crowded bus drew closer to the capital of Uruguay. A $20,000 Rolex I'd bought in Puerto Rico was on my left arm. Not until then did I see it had garnered attention from the passengers, people who didn't make that much in a year. When I had been with Scams in Arizona, by their taste, the watch was pedestrian. Over and over, someone pointed at me and said, "Rico, es hombre muy rico." The Rolex made them think I was a rich man. The watch meant nothing to me. I told them, "No soy rico. El reloj no es auténtico. Es una imitación. Soy pobre como tú." The paisitos laughed, nodded, believing me when I told them it was a knockoff. lost interest in my Rolex, and went back to their lives. In English, my Russian-born mentor, Konstantin, said, "Gideon, shotgun. Get ready to roll out." The bus stopped, and the crowd started gathering their belongings. Raincoats, winter coats, umbrellas. Some wore plastic or garbage bags to stay dry. Some carried their belongings and had no umbrella, moved as if the cold rain was a summer drizzle. I waited a moment, sweating due to discomfort that wouldn't let me be. When I tried to stand up, the throbbing from the beating grew, then doubled up and hit me like Mike Tyson in his fight with Spinks. I took short breaths to quell the agony, gripped the backs of two seats to stay afloat. Shotgun heard me grunt, then looked back and asked,
"You okay?"
"I'm good. Just had a moment. Been sitting down on my injuries too long."
"Well, you need to walk to get your blood circulating. Don't need no blood clot."
The moment I stepped off the bus in Montevideo, it felt like the world was made of jello. But I was going to fight it. Collapsing would mean that Medianoche had won this battle. I asked, "Are we going to try and get out of Carrasco International Airport?" Konstantin shook his head. "No, they would be on alert. We keep to the original plan." I said, "We exit out of Brazil." Konstantin nodded. I said, "Brazil stinks." Shotgun asked,
"How come?"
"They have bad sewage systems. In a lot of the bathrooms, they put their toilet paper in a trash can, and when the trash is full, they keep throwing more toilet paper on top." Shotgun said,
"Doo-doo paper? Like Charmin?"
"Yeah, doo-doo paper like Charmin."
"That's nasty. Like down in the country with outhouses nasty. My granddaddy and them lived down in Grenada, Mississippi, behind a lumberyard, and those outhouses was nasty."
And to make it worse, they had padded toilet seats that stick to your butt, too.
"Well, I hope the streets there are cleaner than the ones in Buenos Aires. Never seen so much dog doo-doo on the streets in my life. They act like they don't even see it."
"Streets in Buenos Aires are as dirty as it's money. They'll fight for the Falklands, but not to make people clean up after their dogs." I was talking, rambling, to keep alert. The conversation meant nothing. As we followed the crowd, the ice-cold rain felt good on my heated skin, but pain threw me on a flaming merry-go-round spinning at 100 miles an hour. I misstepped. Shotgun grabbed my shoulder, kept me from going down to the ground. I got my balance, limped along with Konstantin, and Shotgun moved to the side of the crowd, got closer to the businesses, hardly able to stand, limped to the wall of a nearby building, doubled over, and began regurgitating. It went on for 10 minutes. I was sweating like it was the 4th of July in Atlanta. The world was a blur. I had too far to go. I put my hand against the nearest wall, grunted, straightened up. Shotgun said,
"You in bad shape, Gideon. Real bad shape. I can see that now."
Able to see out of only one eye, I said, "Just point me in the direction we're going." Arm wounded and in a sling, Konstantin was bruised too. They had been in the shootout of all shootouts in the middle of the streets. The Russian had been a true warrior. If not for him, Scamzito and Arizona, his queen Scams, as well as her younger sister, Sierra, would all be dead. Arizona's brother hadn't been so lucky. He had taken a bullet, was killed in the streets. His corpse was on the yacht with them, a floating mortuary. Konstantin said, "We need to get Gideon to another doctor." I said, "I'm good." "You probably have a fever. You're infected. That's why you're puking." Shotgun told Konstantin,
"It was real nasty where we was, where you had that fight."
As people who called themselves paisitos, people from the little country of Uruguay, passed by, I had to lean against another wall. Medianoche had gotten the best of me. I had wanted to leave that motherfucker midnight gurgling in the mud. If I had had it my way, he would have died of a broken neck after his spine had been shattered into a million pieces. Konstantin said, "Big city. Places to hide. We can't stay here too long." Shotgun nodded.
"Bunch of people looking at us and talking real fast in Spanish."
I sucked it up and we sped up, hobbled along at the pace of the walking wounded. Konstantin and Shotgun led the way as we traversed through Spanish colonial and Art Deco structures. It felt like I had hiked a marathon by the time we had made it to the open shopping area, the flea market at Plaza Constitucion. The side of Constantine's face was still bloodied, Shotgun was probably in the best shape of the three of us, but he wasn't near 100%. We were battle-worn, but we were also hungry. We grabbed some of the local delicacies, chivito and asado, puchero and pasquilina. Shotgun didn't ask what was in it. He ate like he was starved. We needed the energy. We ate fast, then had to hustle by museums, churches, and government buildings, then rush through the gateway of Ciudadela and get to Ciudad Vieja. Constantine said, "Gideon, son, you're not in any condition to go to Brazil. Not today." "I'm fine. I'll slow it down when we get across the border." "No, in your shape, you won't make it 3 more hours. You're fucked up. We need to make a new plan. I see where you're hurt on the outside, but you might be busted up inside, too." Shotgun said,
"He's right, Gideon. Listen to the man. You went 12 rounds over there."
Trying not to sound paranoid, I said, "We're not far from the Four Horsemen." Shotgun nodded.
"They're across that river that looks like the Mississippi on steroids."
Constantine said, "I'll get us some better hardware. Then I'll get us a place to regroup." Constantine had a contact in the area, a man who had ties to an arms dealer on the run. Constantine ordered us some equipment, said we could get armed with Steyr AUGs and FAMAS assault rifles, weapons many used, including the New Zealand forces. When we were back near the artsy shops and galleries, we sat down in a cafe. They sat down to force me to rest a moment. Shotgun was a big man in a land of Lilliputians, so it was hard finding anything in his size. He stood out in this part of the world. Uruguayan kids ran over and tried to sneak pictures with him when he wasn't looking. It scared Shotgun. After what we had been through, anyone who came too close could be the enemy, children included. Children had shot at us on the other side of the river. Children working for the horsemen had tried to put us to sleep. Shotgun said,
"I definitely ain't in Atlanta no more. Nothing down here to remind me of Malcolm X or Martin Luther King. It's like we landed in a different universe with all the signs in Spanish."
"It's its own world here."
"Sounded like the Korean folks we passed by were speaking Spanish. Ain't never seen that before. Korean folks in South America speaking Spanish better than Mexicans?"
We found some new clothes for all of us. Constantine even found himself another suit and a new pair of white shoes. I went into a bathroom, redressed my wounds. 2 stitches had popped. Those small wounds were too open. Constantine tried to find a doctor. One could be there in an hour, but we decided we were getting too much attention and moved on. Constantine arranged a ride to a place we could lie low for a while. A Brazilian man came to us and loaded us in his small car. It was a tight fit, but we were moving in the right direction. I sat in the back seat with Shotgun. As soon as we started to roll, I was in and out of consciousness again. I tried to stay awake, especially since I had taken blows to the head, but my body kept shutting down. When I came to, still groggy, Shotgun and Constantine were talking. Shotgun said,
"We need to get into an emergency room or another doctor."
"We'll get into a bed and I'll make a few calls. If we're not going to be able to exit this plan, if we're going to be trapped here with the condition we're in, I'll call Hawks and the..." Then I was gone again. Not all the way, but the world was a blur. Their words garbled. The weather worsened, as did my injuries, and both slowed us down. I shivered, and the shivers went on for 20 minutes, if not longer. Constantine was right. My external wounds were obvious. If I was busted up on the inside, I had no idea how bad. I had taken too many hard blows, not just against Medianoche. I couldn't remember half the men I'd fought, beaten, and killed. I couldn't remember the number of men who had fought, beaten, and almost killed me. Once upon a time, I had died. Today might be the day I made that journey again. My vision remained blurry. The trip was like being driven through clouds. It hurt to inhale. I couldn't breathe. Had to find a better position so I didn't suffocate. When I shifted and moved my body, pain marched in circles, stabbed me with fiery bayonets. It took a lifetime to make it 185 miles to Punta del Diablo, a sleepy sea town with a population of no more than 400. It was good that that was as far as we were going because the aching became too much to bear. I threw up again, did that until there was nothing in my stomach, and after that it was 10 minutes of dry heaving. Where we stopped was like being in the country, more blue-collar only by the raging sea. The land of the poor, where each home housed at least three generations. Colorful fishing boats were in the sand. Each inhale was the scent of the river. Constantine asked, "Can you handle getting him out of the vehicle?"
"I got him. He's a heavy so-and-so."
The next thing I knew, I was falling. I dreamed I was being thrown into an open grave, but jerked awake and landed on a bed. Constantine was on the phone. Sounded like he was talking to the assassin, Hawks, again. Heard him say Memphis. That's where she was. He made another call. I heard him say something about trying to contact another assassin, the Bajan. The safe house was in an area of fishermen and artisans, was a small hotel, and it helped that this wasn't tourist season. Constantine said, "I know toys will be here within the hour." Shotgun asked,
"Hope we're gonna get some bombs and rocket launchers like they had."
"We're not gonna be armed like the Four Horsemen, but we won't stay naked."
I had lacerations, and the open wounds had been exposed to the raw sewage and mud in the Vichas of Buenos Aires. I knew I needed antibiotics and more band-aids. We'd left all the medicine on the yacht with Skemzito and his half-dead crew. I stood up long enough to look out the window at the rain. Again, a wave of pain came, took me to my knees, then to the tiled floor. The room did that merry-go-round number again. I fell into a warm pool of darkness. A voice called out,
"Get in! Get in! Get in! Fuck, did you pass out again?"
When I looked up, Constantine was there, arm in a sling, trying to pull me up. I sat on the bed. He made me get horizontal and played doctor the best he could. He said,
"Somehow, Midnight is alive."
"Yeah.
When you were a boy, you saw him die, right? With your own eyes."
"Yes." I thought back to when I was 7. I shot him in the head.
"Then what?"
"My mother held me. I held her. He had beat her bad, I remember that. The noise woke me up. He was choking her. Had her up in the air. Had almost broken her neck."
"Did you check his body? Think back to then. Did you take a pulse?"
"We covered it with a sheet. Got away from him. It was a dead body. I was 7. My mother was scared. She didn't want to touch him. We ran away on a greyhound. Had no money. Old folks gave us chicken. Never will forget that. Ended up in Montreal. We were penniless." I remembered us being penniless, but happier. I remembered my mother buying me a comic book. Then I sat on a stoop and read it while she smoked and taught me to speak French. She was calm, relaxed, when she thought Midnight was dead. One of our best days. Quebec was good for us for a while. Constantine looked at my swollen eye.
"Jesus fucking Christ, son. When did you fight him?"
"After we had the second briefcase, I went back after him. I fucked up."
"Gideon, fuck, you should have focused on the job. You put us all at risk."
"I know, I fucked up, yeah. I had to face him. I know he's alive. I know he's real."
"Son, he's a fucking merc. We're hired guns. We don't operate on their level. We use a .22 or a plastic bag, or drown him in a bathtub. They think they're fighting a war in Vietnam."
"Yeah, I know. But we managed to beat him. I killed one of them."
"He knows you're alive. He knows you're the one who left him for dead. Your mother..."
"I told him Thelma was... told him she was... deceased. I told him that my mother... my mother..." My voice faded. That warm black pool came back for me. This time, I didn't fight it.
Chapter 5. Dangerous Profession. Medianoche dressed, put on his dark suit, dark shirt, dark tie, and dark trench coat. He was armed with 3 guns, 2 in holsters, another in an ankle strap. 2 blades were in his gear as well. Once he was outfitted in his tailored clothing, all lined in Kevlar, he adjusted what was most important. The black tie stated who he was in The Horseman. Revelations, Chapter 6. Loosely interpreted, black was the color of the horse written by the lawgiver, the one carrying the scales of justice.
He helped Caprica with her dress, then eased on her gray wool coat. Caprica Ortiz said,
"My contact will call me back as soon as possible.
I know that people down here don't rush, but I need it on North American time."
"Understood. But I am not in control. Only the person in the middle."
"I need more than name recognition and praise for a two-bit hired gun."
"There are rumors that he killed at least 15 people on the island of Antigua."
"Rumor is just a fancy word for gossip. I deal in facts, hard facts. I need my war to go in the right direction.
Tell your contact I said that."
"I will get facts. What do you need to know regarding Gideon?"
"Did he leave Argentina? Or did he and the rest of those mutts lay low?"
"I don't know."
He hadn't been thinking like the Beast. He never should have come to this hotel. The enemy could still be in the city, could be outside his door, waiting. Medianoche hid a gun under the fedora in his hand. Disheveled sheets behind him, he left the room first, then motioned for Caprica to follow. He put her on his left side. She put her arm in his. Even now, he treated her like the lady she was. He was thankful that his abusive father had beaten gentlemanly ways and manners into his bones. That drunk bastard did have manners. On the elevator, alone with the married woman he'd had 6 ways to Sunday, Medianoche stared at his own reflection in the metal part of the vertical carriage. He saw the shop-worn face of a mercenary. Like his left eye, his youth would never return. The elevator stopped. Medianoche stood with the business end of his gun aimed at the unknown. The door opened. A group of middle-aged men got on. Germans. All wore suits. Medianoche's senses caught fire. Each man was armed. Not wanting to be cornered in a moving coffin, he touched Caprica's arm, held her biceps, led her off the elevator, let the Germans have the lift. Once it was gone, he pushed the button, called for another vertical carriage. She said,
"Those men, they stared at me. One looks familiar."
"Stay at my left side. My weapon is in my right hand." His 9mm remained hidden by his fedora. Caprica Ortiz didn't question him. That told Medianoche she was no stranger to violence. Her world was wicked. The next carriage was empty. He told her to get on, and he would meet her in the lobby. She refused to leave him. He took her hand and led her to the stairs. Even then, he smelled the scent of bad men. Men like him. They exited the stairwell at the ground level. Medianoche searched for the Germans he had seen. None waited for him. There was no ambush. He rounded the corner, entered the section with a bar, lounge, and dining area, and there they were. He saw Russians, Frenchmen, Africans, Jamaicans, Middle Easterners. They were in separate spaces, like each corner was a temporary embassy, drinking like they were in Rick's Cafe. He saw men who wore Kevlar-lined clothing and traveled only in cars that were bulletproof and had run-flat tires. Caprica frowned at those men, then stepped forward. She looked for faces she had hunted over the decades, searched for her version of Dr. Gerhard Bonne, Joseph Mengele, or Adolf Eichmann. She found no one. Medianoche saw that expression of disappointment, anger, and fear. Then the tenseness in her body gradually dissipated. But Medianoche saw a familiar face, a man who had no business in his country. Eye contact was made. Medianoche was tempted to go to that man, gun first, but he moved on, Caprica Ortiz at his side. He wanted to get her out of the building, away from trouble, out of his affairs. He told her, "Don't forget what I need, who I need you to locate."
"Gideon, I should be back from my source by morning."
"And don't forget Arizona and Scams. His name is spelled S-C-A-M-Z, a Latin man with a strong British accent."
"I will be your person in the middle, but to be clear, doing business comes at a cost, and that price will be deducted from your fee, from my next contract."
"Who is your contact? Is it someone military or in the Argentine government?"
She moved her gray hair from her face. "I will never say. It would not be wise."
She was lean, like most of the women in Buenos Aires, and definitely of Italian ancestry. Men and women passed, whispering, "Cambio, cambio." Hustlers exchanged dollars for pesos at a better rate than hotels and casas de cambio. But sometimes tourists ended up trading good money for counterfeit bills. Medianoche escorted her to a black and yellow radio taxi. He shook her hand as if it were the end of a grueling business meeting, nothing more. He opened the door. She eased inside. Once inside, where she could not be seen, she smiled like she wanted a goodbye kiss. Medianoche said, "I enjoyed you."
"Igualmente."
"Ciao."
"Ciao."
Her taxi pulled away, blended with 1,000 vehicles, most of them driven by shit drivers. Medianoche watched Caprico Ortiz's taxi until it disappeared in traffic that rivaled the madness at the Arc de Triomphe in Paris. He watched to make sure Caprico Ortiz wasn't being followed. It was after 1 in the morning, and the city was just waking up. Clubs didn't get busy until 3 a.m., and no one had gone to dinner before 10 p.m. He frowned at the amazing nocturnal city. Sirens, horns. Buenos Aires was the Paris of South America, but like no other place in the world. His gun was ready. It had been ready. He knew a man was creeping up on him. Without looking behind him, Medianoche asked, "What are you doing in my country?"
"¿Qué haces, boludo? You know I came for the steak, medialunas, and tango. Tienes más mentiras que el truco. Why would I lie to a man of your stature? That would be bad for my health. I'd hoped scum like you would come to clean up the mounds of dog shit all over the city."
Medianoche turned, faced a well-built Israeli, a 60-year-old man no longer welcomed in his own country of warriors. Assad held a trench coat over his arm, a gun in his hidden hand. Medianoche said, "With your war crimes, I'm surprised you haven't been beheaded."
"Enemies have been many, but fate has been kind, and my escapes have been swift."
Medianoche stopped pointing his gun at Benjamin Assad's heart. Assad relaxed his weapon at the same time.
"Do you mind if we get out of the weather?"
"I have somewhere to be."
"When has anyone in Buenos Aires ever been on time for anything? You show up 2 hours late, you are still earlier than everyone else. La noche está en Peñales. Come inside."
Medianoche followed Assad back inside the hotel, into the lobby, toward the Russians, the Nigerians. Assad stopped a dozen feet away before facing Medianoche. They were far enough away to not be heard, but they could be seen. Medianoche knew Assad could have jawjacked outside, but he was a man who liked to impress. He wanted to be seen talking to a horseman in order to elevate his status, his value among the others. Again, Medianoche asked, "What brings you back here?"
"Rescatate. Calm down, my friend. The beast didn't tell you our arrangement?"
"He tells me what I need to know, the important things. I assume it's another auction?"
"Of course."
"Of course. And the fees will be paid to our group when all is done?" Assad nodded, evaluated Medianoche's face.
"You did not win the prize."
"What prize are you referring to, Assad?"
"The chatter is, the four horsemen had an interesting day and frustrating night."
"Care to elaborate?"
"When all was said and done, the four horsemen were not victorious."
"We are always victorious. What we were hired to do, we accomplished."
"A British man named Scams is telling everyone he bested the four horsemen."
"Never heard of a British man named Scams."
"De repente tienes una vena."
"Dame la goma. Tomatela. I'm not about to blow a fuse." Assad offered a smile that reminded Medianoche of Lee Harvey Oswald.
"You're almost not recognizable. You have taken a beating as if you have been in the La Boca pits. The word is, you had a moment with one of Scams's men in the Vichas."
"Heard it was quite the battle. Are you or someone in this room working with Scams's cowardly organization?"
"Ah, you do know him."
"Fucking answer me, or end up with one eye less than I have."
"Scams is new in the arena, and has quickly built his reputation on your back."
"How many of them are dead? Did the pregnant Asian bitch who calls herself Arizona die at the base of General Justo Jose de Urquiza? Did she bleed out in the streets at the roundabout?"
I have no idea who died where, when, nor why. Only know scams bested you.
He's a dead man walking. Same goes for anyone who comes my way on his behalf.
Well, I will say this, and I say this in confidentiality. Beware of the Uruguayans.
Fuck the Uruguayans. Me chupa un huevo.
Many of their men died here 2 days ago. You created widows and orphans.
Unless they have a deal with a coffin maker, they know to stay across the river.
Assad smiled.
We have a plane load of Russian and American-made weaponry to sell. We have armament that has been intercepted, equipment meant for the Allies. No serial numbers.
My inventory is deep, but will not be deep for long.
Come to the auction. An M4 will go for $4,000. My AT-4 rocket launchers are on special at $2,000.
No one beats my prices.
Buy a drone. Every man in your business should have a drone. I'm offering a General Atomics MQ-1 Predator for $3 million, a million cheaper than anyone else. Consider buying the drone.
Medianoche paused, stuck on the fact that scams had somehow boasted of his victory and men were arriving here on his turf because now they sensed the horsemen were weak.
Medianoche spoke casually.
If we become interested, you will deal with me.
Assad smiled, as if that had answered an unspoken question.
Not with the beast?
Be glad we didn't meet you when you arrived, Assad.
Unfazed, Assad said,
Maybe we will talk more when I see you in a couple of hours.
Why would I see you in a few hours?
The beast didn't tell you about our most recent agreement?
You tell me, then I will verify what you say with him.
Colombia was too violent. We grew weary of dealing with the Colombian government, paramilitary groups, crime syndicates, and left-wing guerrillas, so now warriors will come here twice a year and brawl in the La Boca pits. They are reopening the pits tonight.
You can go to El Lugar Repugnante and play your games. Let your boys be gladiators, but keep this in mind, Assad. You are on 4 horsemen grounds. After the death matches, once you have concluded your arms sales, rinse down the blood, get rid of the bodies, and leave my country as fast as you can. And we expect our cut from the activity in the pits as well.
You're not a Porteña. You're an American, an expatriate, an immigrant on this soil.
Try me. Wise guy, fucking try me. I own wherever I stand, no matter the country.
The beast was notified, and he agreed. So if there is a change, I need to hear that from your leader, from the beast, not from his executive officer, who has been left out of the loop.
If you have heard it from me, then you have heard it from the beast. I just told you your new walking orders, so let me know if we have a problem, and I'll fix it right now.
Assad, with his Lee Harvey Oswald smile, said,
Be careful dealing with Caprica Ortiz.
Medianoche paused.
Caprica Ortiz is none of your concern.
She offends people in high places. Some say it goes as far as Casa Rosado.
Not your fucking business.
Walk away from her.
As they say, don't shit where you eat.
Have a good night, Assad. You have 2 days to get the fuck out of Argentina.
If my business affairs are not concluded by then?
Buy yourself and whoever is standing at your side a mausoleum.
Assad went back to his cavalry, gun underneath his trench coat. He said something to his Spartans. Then he and his Kevlar-suited warriors raised their glasses to Medianoche as an insult. Again, Medianoche took in the other men in the lobby. Frenchmen, Africans, Japanese, men from Brazil. They taunted Medianoche's loss. They disrespected the death of his soldiers. An army that lost a war in its own country was looked down upon. He walked to the center of the room, stood in challenge.
You pussies have something to say? Stand the fuck up! Assad was outside licking my balls and saying that someone in this fucking room wanted to challenge the 4 horsemen.
A hush fell across the room. Medianoche said,
Who wants to stand up and talk shit to a horseman? We can make this space our new El Lugar Repugnante.
Men who had dared now became nervous. Before Medianoche was a horseman, he was a man called Midnight.
Midnight had served many men their final darkness. All in the room knew that. He had been legendary in the pits. They had seen him step in the ring and throw one blow. One blow, and the fight was done, and his challenger was on the floor, dead. They had seen him battle adversaries with swords, and the man before them won every time with only his fists.
Have your drinks. Have as many women as you can, and have auction and the fights. Then get out of my country. The Four Horsemen will bury anyone left behind, and you won't be dead when your body is put in the ground, head first. You won't be close to dead.
No one said a word. No one stood. No one reached for a gun. That was the echo of fear. That was the reverberation of respect.
And we will expect 50% of the take from the games in the pits.
Men shifted, looked unhappy. The fee double the normal. But no one said a word. Medianoche turned around and left the hotel, loaded guns still under his fedora, ready to pop off a few. He walked beyond where he had put Keptica Ortiz in a taxi. He walked down the avenue, where every building complemented the next, and every man wore proper shoes, acceptable jeans, had his shirt tucked in, and wore a jacket that fit correctly. Up in the States, pathetic men wore clothes made for clowns, had their pants sagging, underwear showing, then called that fashion. His father had beat him if his clothes were out of order, made him proper. Buenos Aires had class, but at the same time, it was a city where no one walked and used an iPhone unless they wanted to be robbed by a hooligan. The city was also filled with horribly dressed tourists, and they always congregated at Plaza Dorrego, Plaza Francia, or La Boca. He passed a wall that had been spray-painted, Las Malvinas son Argentinas. That message meant that the Malvinas belonged to Argentina, not to the fucking British. That war was a sore spot and left both anger and embarrassment in the air. It would always be about war. Be it your toys or a country, you had to fight for what was yours. You had to keep others from taking what was yours, or you would end up shot or thrown out of airplanes over the ocean after you had been blindfolded, tortured, and raped. Medianoche paused, checked to see if Assad or some other fool was shadowing him, then turned around, moved on, inhaled the endemic corruption in the air. With inflation running at about 30% per year, despite everything in sight being built with opulence in mind, he was surprised anyone survived here. It was the land of the rich and the poor. No such thing as a real middle class. Two dog walkers, pasiperos, passed by, each being led by 24 dogs. Dogs were a status symbol. Walking dogs and leaving mountains of canine shit behind, an honorable profession. Tourists were easy to spot. Fat ones, Americans. Ones with bad teeth, British. The pale ones were Canadians. Visitors wore tennis shoes and did a bad job of avoiding the dog shit. Most stayed in Palermo, where people spoke English and drank at Starbucks. Argentine women wore 5-inch heels and walked down cobblestone streets like pros. Same-sex couples passed by. No one cared in Buenos Aires. Droves of poor children were out selling flowers and begging, if not stealing. Some had been trafficked and would work until sunrise. By the age of 6, children from the Vichas were expert pickpockets and dangerous. He passed a cartoneo who was separating trash to find cardboard and other recyclable goods to earn a dime. The man's cart was loaded and cardboard was stacked 10 feet high, like he had braved the rain and the cold and covered at least 25 blocks. Many men worked all day, then spent the night hustling cardboard and plastic. Medianoche passed them all. None fucked with him. Bad people knew a bad man. He was the baddest of them all. A few blocks later, he put the gun away, slid the fedora onto his head, and, dressed in darkness from head to toe, the hue of midnight, kept his arm low. The proper way to hail a taxi. Hailing high was for a bus. A moment later, he eased into the next available cab. Their taxis were black with yellow tops, looked like 4-door bumblebees. A slight headache came on. He attributed that to the stress. He told the aged and overweight Peruvian driver his destination. He looked back,
checked again to make sure no fool had tailed him, and waited for him to turn his back so they could come at him, guns blazing. He had left himself too damn vulnerable. His anger came unbridled, and there was an abrupt flash of brightness. Medianoche cringed, reached to hold his head, tried to stop it from occurring again. As it had been inside the hotel room, Buenos Aires became white light. Old images went by, the brain whirring, clicking like an old projector. 1,000 blurred images. Everything went blank. Then time had no meaning. Like he had been on the floor of that brothel in North Carolina, he was dead. Chapter 6. Between Midnight and Dawn. Medianoche heard the aged Peruvian driver shouting. It sounded like the man was far, far away, but with each shout he came closer. Medianoche finally blinked, his only eye coming into focus. He realized they were miles away from where he had gotten inside the radio taxi, were parked in front of the penthouse that housed the four horsemen. In Spanish, in a state of fright, the taxi driver yelled, "Mister, are you okay?"
How long have we been double parked here, blocking traffic?
Señor, I called for your attention many times for more than 2 minutes. I thought you had died. I was going to drive your body to Hospital Alemán.
He had been lost in purgatory for the duration of the ride, from practically the moment he stepped in the taxi. He had died again, this time, for at least 15 goddamn minutes. He walked toward the building, then stopped when he spotted something on the ground. At first he thought it was a shattered cell phone. It wasn't. It was a broken sensor. It had been used to track the briefcases. He stepped on it, crunched it under his shoe. When Medianoche exited their private elevator at the 17th floor, 18 floors above Buenos Aires' concrete jungle, another mercenary waited. He smelled her belligerence and argumentativeness before he exited the lift. The mercenary's given name was Amaravati Panchali Ganeshis. In South America, she was Señorita Raven. The Punjabi was the other remaining member of the Four Horsemen. She had survived the battle against the scams organization. She was the last member to be recruited, chosen by the Beast. She was a woman born in Mumbai, but who grew up in the ghettos of St. Louis. Wavy black hair, high cheekbones, dark lipstick, red winter coat, white sweater, black skinny jeans, red boots, red purse. Señorita Raven paced the hallway. Medianoche exited the ThyssenKrupp elevator and frowned at the Punjabi. Solid woman. Had outrun him in the battle last night. The skinny jeans.